special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by Rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we highlight two courageous, muckraking journalists. We're going to be joined by investigative journalist Will Carruthers and Whitney Webb. First, we'll talk with Will Carruthers about his piece in The Bohemian in Northern California called Juiced, about how PG&E poured $2 million into a nonprofit foundation as the utility ramped up its political machine after the 2017 wildfires. Then we'll turn to Whitney Webb, and we'll focus on her recent series at Mint Press News on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. Please stay with us.
Stakes are tied, thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, skies under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons build the capacity citizens, in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, times running out the reach, all potential fame.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. In this segment of the program, we are introducing The Power Brokers, which is going to be a series on the intersection of politics and power in the North Bay, the North San Francisco Bay and beyond. So this is going to be an independent journalism, a local independent journalism type series. But I think as you'll see today, they are stories that have broad implications, statewide for California, nationwide in many ways, even global. Of course, this is a series by a colleague of Project Censored. For years, we've known the independent journalist Peter Byrne. He is contributing to this series and the article that we're going to talk about today. He was supported in part by a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. On this segment for the program today, we are joined by freelance and independent journalist Will Carruthers. Will Carruthers is in the Northern California area, Santa Rosa, and writes for several places, including the local paper Bohemian. You can learn more at bohemian.com, and his name is Will Carruthers, C-A-R-R-U-T-H-E-R-S, for those of you that would like to look it up online. In this first segment, we're going to look at an article that Carruthers published very recently called Juiced, PG&E poured $2 million into the Rebuild North Bay Foundation as the utility ramped up its political machine after the 2017 wildfires in Northern California. Now, this is a long and winding story, and we have Will Carruthers in studio with us. Let's welcome Will Carruthers to the program. Will, thanks for coming in.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this Power Brokers series that you are starting with Peter Byrne for The Bohemian.
This is the first piece in the series, and it is, among other things, looking into, as you mentioned, power brokers in the North Bay, because we're based here, and mainly Darius Anderson, who is a lobbyist and power broker, if you will, based in North Bay with a Sacramento-based lobbying firm called Platinum Advisors.
Right. So Darius Anderson is a name that's come up on the program before with Peter Byrne. I mean, Will Carruthers, let's get into some of the specifics of the story. Obviously, Anderson is a component of it. Some California politicians are clearly part of it, including State Senator Bill Dodd. Can you give us a little background on this column in particular? This story takes a look at the intersections, right? You call power brokers, the major power company PG&E, also nonprofit Rebuild North Bay Foundation after the wildfires. But it also includes North Bay media, right? North Bay media outlets, in particular, the Santa Rosa paper, the Press Democrat, and Darian Anderson's connection to that paper, which is...
Right. In 2011 and 2012, Anderson and a group of business people, mostly based in North Bay, purchased the Press Democrat and a number of other local papers, including the North Bay Business Journal. And the umbrella company is Sonoma Media Investments. For this story, it's basically, as you mentioned, those three entities, Sonoma Media Investments, Rebuild North Bay Foundation, and Anderson's lobbying firm, Platinum Advisors. And so we're exploring in this story is how those three have overlapped in the past 2 years. What started it in October 2017, after the fires, Anderson started very quickly this nonprofit called the Rebuild North Bay Foundation, and he was saying that it was an effort to bring together public and private interests to rebuild after the fires. Sounded like a good thing to do, but we were looking into it, Peter Byrne and I, because of the people he had on the board and also because of interest in what they had actually accomplished over the first year and a half they were around. So we inquired with the director of the nonprofit, and she sent us some of their donors over the first year and a half of existence. And what we found out was that PG&E had contributed $2 million to the nonprofit in December 2017, so fairly shortly after the fires.
Darius Anderson starts this nonprofit. That's the Rebuild North Bay Foundation.
Right.
Darius Anderson also is the person that owns the Sonoma Media Investments, which owns the Press Democrat.
Right.
And Anderson is also a registered lobbyist for PG&E.
Right. This is a story that the Bohemian was following before I came along. And basically, the inklings of something started last March when Tom Gogol at the Bohemian reported that Anderson had signed on as a lobbyist formally with PG&E, because you have to register with the Secretary of State. Formally lobbying for something is something official. And so he registered in March of 2018, and then the Bohemian reported at the time. To my knowledge, the Press Democrat has never come out and said part owner is lobbying for PG&E. So that was the lead of this story, is that there's a second batch of wildfire legislation they're trying to pass, and Governor Newsom was trying to push through very quickly from the public's perspective. And so he was pushing to get it passed by July 12th. And
for a summer break so that the political class can all go out and do their vacationing.
Summer vacation. And so he gave two reasons. He said that the fire season is approaching, and also the credit rating agencies for PG&E and other utilities were threatening to further downgrade.
Right. And so the LA Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, you wrote in the piece, weren't persuaded, and they urged the assembly to, quote, say no to being rushed by Wall Street into the hasty adoption of a complex law that puts Californians on the hook for billions of dollars. As we mentioned earlier, Darius Anderson has the ownership stake in the Press Democrat and some of these other North Bay business journals. What do we hear from those outlets in regards to the passing of this bill?
Well, I quote their editorial from that week, and they basically are saying there's nothing to worry about here. They actually say something to the effect of, some people are calling this a bailout, but don't worry, it's not a bailout. And then they end it by just saying, we don't need to wait any longer.
Why would they, given that Darius Anderson owns the paper, is behind the nonprofit, and is a lobbyist for PG&E? I mean, how that's even permissible is an indictment of our entire political structure and funding system. But I also wanted to make sure listeners knew that you're now talking about the legislation AB 1054, is that right?
Right, yeah. Okay.
I just want to make sure that listeners know, sometimes when we talk about some of these issues and you get into some of the more specific titles or names of the bills and so on, some people do miss that, or some people don't necessarily follow. And also, the reason that it's important, as Chase was asking, the reason it's important to figure out what the major papers are saying is figuring out what's in this bill and how does it work. I mean, you write here that this is a bill, AB 1054, that would establish a $21 billion wildfire fund that would be half funded by ratepayers.
Right. $10.5 billion would come from ratepayers. That would be an extension, actually, of a fee that they put on ratepayers after the Enron energy crisis. So that's one of the things it does. Another interesting aspect of it is that actually this San Francisco delegations of elected officials voted against AB 1054. Their given reason was that it will make it more difficult for local governments and the state to actually buy out PG&E or any of the utilities. So what it does is it requires the CPUC to sign off on any purchase of part or all of a utility, which is just an extra hurdle that was not there before.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Chase Palmieri, and we are speaking with independent and freelance journalist Will Carruthers. He writes for The Bohemian in Northern California, and you can learn more at bohemian.com. It has several pieces there. The one we're discussing right now is titled Juiced. PG&E poured $2 million into the Rebuild North Bay Foundation as the utility ramped up its political machine after 2017 wildfires. Now, we at least have it out here who Darius Anderson is, and it seems a central player between the Press Democrat and their pro AB 1054 position. Obviously not a surprise in that regard. We also know that he's behind the nonprofit and also was a registered lobbyist for PG&E. PG&E sunk a couple million dollars into this nonprofit, which apparently nobody at the paper thought that that was worth reporting. Is that right?
Apparently not. I mean, I think these things from the outside are kind of hard to piece apart sometimes. I mean, as I note in the story, they didn't respond to a request for comment. Obviously, when you're inside a paper and you know that your boss is a lobbyist for PG&E, that would dissuade you from doing that. I should say they do run articles about PG&E. Obviously, it would be a glaring omission if they did
In this part of the country, it would be impossible for them to not utter those letters.
Right. But as I said, the issue here is that they don't disclose. I mean, it would change the way you read their articles. Right?
Which is why we need independent journalism and why we need journalists like you to go and dig through the weeds, right? And find out this kind of information and perform a civic duty to tell people this is what's going on. Right? With this utility company, the media that's allegedly telling the public what's going on. This is obviously for us an issue of censorship, and it's something that the Press Democrat should not be engaging in at all, no matter who their owner is, right? Mm-hmm. If they actually had journalistic principles, they're violating, of course, the Society of Professional Journalists Professional Ethics Guide in many, many areas, which is terribly unfortunate, particularly since it's also a paper that had some award-winning coverage of the fires, right?
Right, yeah.
So it's interesting that they get to parade that out in you know, they get to wear that ribbon to the ball, so to speak. But behind the scenes, they're doing a huge disservice to the public by sitting on this information and not connecting any of these dots.
I don't think a lot of this stuff has come out before. There's a lot of, like, vague suspicions and
well, you write about, you know, Californians for Energy Choice basically say that AB 1054 is a PG&E bailout, even though the Press Democrat is claiming that it isn't.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So you definitely have people that are accusing them of these things and the fact that they're not covering these things. Let's twist it in just one more direction, because we haven't gotten to the Sacramento legislature yet. There's some key players there. Who's one of the key players there?
This section of the story was about Senator Bill Dodd, and he represents parts of the North Bay. I want to say here that we did focus on him because he represents part of the Bohemians coverage area. But he also got a very important role in writing legislation after the wildfires that relates to utilities. So as I note in the article, PG&E has been a very big political power for a long time. And what I wanted to do in the article, outline the parameters of that. Governor Newsom has taken money from PG&E, and ABC 10 in Sacramento reported recently that 8 out of 10 lawmakers have taken money directly from PG&E since 2017. I just want to give the context of they're giving money everywhere. In the case of Bill Dodd, I think he received a lot of money in his 2016 campaign, or independent expenditure committees on his behalf received a lot of money. And what we outline in the article is that he also, in the past year, attended a fundraiser at one of Darius Anderson's properties, a hunting club in Sonoma County. And also the closing scene of the article is him speaking to a audience of Platinum Advisors employees and clients alongside the director of Rebuild North Bay and the CEO of Sonoma Media Investments. So that is the scope of how much political influence and different ways that you can try to influence politicians, basically.
And what I noticed out of this piece is that it seems like some of this PG&E funding to these politicians and the money being spent on the lobbyists, the optics of it looks like it comes immediately after the wildfires, almost like they're preparing themselves for the hate that was eventually going to come their way. Can you speak to kind of the timing of these donations?
Sure. The $2 million immediately in December 2017 is the earliest large payment of that size that I've seen. But you're right. I mean, they spent about $1.9 million on direct lobbying in 2017 and then $9.9 in 2018. So this is the second year in a row, 2019, that they've had significant legislation in front of the California legislature to basically determine the rules about wildfires, because wildfires are, as people like to say, the new normal in California. And I think just if you were in PG&E's shoes, it's a thing that really changes the dynamics of their business. And it's apparent that wildfires will keep happening. So they were incentivized to get involved with the political process.
We're speaking with freelance journalist Will Carruthers. We're going to continue our conversation after this musical break. Stay with us. We're speaking with freelance journalist Will Carruthers. He writes in Northern California for Bohemian, and you can learn more at bohemian.com. Of course, Will is a freelance writer. He's also kicking off with independent journalist Peter Byrne a series called The Power Brokers, and it's going to look at the intersection of politics and power in the North Bay and beyond. And again, it's the "and beyond" part that I want to stress here, because as you hear the conversation, we're talking about a massive utility. We're talking about party political machinery. We're talking about the ownership of media. I mean, in a nutshell, this is the problem all over the country.
Yeah.
Right, in metropolitan areas. Like, this isn't just something that's, oh, this is just happening in Santa Rosa.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
So I want to make sure listeners, you know, can realize that and kind of extrapolate that from the story. I wanted to go back quickly. You know, I know Bill Dodd. I've dealt with Bill Dodd a number of occasions, worked with him a little bit on a critical media literacy bill, or what they called a media literacy bill, you know, a while back, dealing with fake news issues and so on. Dodd's been around. You know, he's a pretty seasoned player. So, not to be cynical, but that he is this well connected and in the middle of some this kind of a big political situation probably shouldn't surprise us, given the district he represents and the money it requires to get things moving in Sacramento. There's nothing terribly surprising as far as that would go. In other words, you mentioned earlier that you weren't specifically targeting him as though he was some...
Oh, sure. Right.
That's not where we're going with this at all. You write about this quite a bit in the article, and again, listeners can go to bohemian.com and see it with Will Carruthers. The article is called Juiced. Can you talk just a little bit more about Dodd's role? And in one statement in 2017, he said he hasn't accepted any political contributions from PG&E. Is that true?
Yes, it is, and as far as I've reviewed it, and...
Okay, so you're just saying yes, but so my question is moving on here... What I want to get at here, is there any other way that maybe these groups or these organizations are funneling more money? Just because the top of this story is PG&E using one of their own lobbyists to create a nonprofit, to create this illusion of independence, and then sinking millions of dollars into it. I mean, Dodd has to know this.
Yeah. His spokesperson said that he did not know that Rebuild had taken the $2 million, and... I will take them at their word about that. And I mean, it was not public knowledge previously. The director of Rebuild says that she told anybody who asked her about it.
That's hardly transparent.
Yeah, and to my knowledge, it was not public knowledge, and clearly it wasn't in the Press Democrat.
Well, it probably won't be, given Darius Anderson's role in this. Well, my question to you, as you know, an independent journalist, a freelance journalist, somebody that clearly was investigating this story deeply in order to connect these dots and put this together.
Right.
Are you going to go back and follow up with these characters? At time of press, Sonoma Media Investments, the company that oversees these newspapers owned by Darius Anderson, they did not have any response. Are you going to go back and follow up with those parties? Are you going to go back and then talk with the people at Rebuild North Bay Foundation? And more specifically, are you going to go back and talk to Bill Dodd?
We are planning to do more coverage of Rebuild North Bay in the coming months and just what they've accomplished and so forth. I didn't have direct plans to talk to Bill Dodd. I know this is obviously PG&E is going to continue to be a issue in front of state lawmakers. I did want to say that the other statement that Dodd's office gave me is that no lobbyists attended any fundraisers for Senator Dodd on behalf of PG&E. And of course, that's a bit of a loose statement.
Right, and explain why.
Well,
it's more than a loose statement. Tell why.
Well, every lobbyist practically, or in this case, Darius Anderson, has a couple dozen clients at any one time. So nailing down somebody that they're working on behalf of PG&E is a little difficult from the outside. But he did say that he attended the Platinum Advisors client retreat, which was last October. And that is obviously all Platinum Advisors employees in the room, and all of them are working for PG&E.
And he previously held a fundraiser at Anderson's property.
Right.
Right? That high-end hunting club.
Yeah, they did not say whether Anderson was actually at the fundraiser, but he did disclose that he had a fundraiser there on one of his disclosures.
Well, we'd certainly be interested here at the Project Censored Show to see more follow-up reporting in the Power Broker series, and certainly about all of these players. I know I've talked to Peter Byrne, and he said he fully intends to continue the pursuit of these characters, and sounds like you're going to maybe do some follow-up and maybe do another piece that looks at some other angles of this story.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. I'm definitely watching different angles, so.
Chase?
I guess if I was going to ask one last question, it would be, what do you see PG&E doing over the next 2 years? Do you think that there is enough legislation to push them to take this financial interest in rebuilding their infrastructure? Or do you think, because of the issues we're talking about today, that accountability is being watered down little by little and that we might not actually see change out of them?
I'll preface it by saying that I'm by no means an expert in utility policy and all of these things. But there are certainly critics of the bill that seem to think that this was not strong enough to make them change their ways. I think there's a Loretta Lynch quote in the article, which basically, and she's the former president of the California Public Utilities Commission, and it's basically saying...
I have the quote right here.
Sure,
So I read it for you. It's... San Francisco Chronicle op-ed published this. This is former CPUC President Loretta Lynch. She wrote, "The legislation is being presented as the only way to compensate victims and stabilize utilities, but it is shockingly stacked in favor of Wall Street and the utilities, and it repeals the California Public Utilities Commission's authority to question the company's claimed costs and past practices." So that's not in the best interest of the public or consumers, right?
Doesn't seem to be. No.
Doesn't seem to be. You finished the article, and I think, which is a really strong way that allows, and I think that you've been very independent in this investigation, and your reporting is pretty impartial. And this is one of the powerful things about this story is you really let the story unfold with the details, right? And that's definitely what good journalism does.
Thanks.
And you conclude here by saying about one of the meetings, right? A panel, one of the panels.
Yeah, this was the Platinum Advisors client retreat.
You noted that the presence of a newspaper executive, the director of a PG&E-funded nonprofit, and a sitting politician charged with regulating utilities at a party thrown by PG&E lobbyists tell a story of Darius Anderson and the utility's influence. That's statewide.
Yeah, yeah.
And for fairness, Sonoma Media Investments and Anderson did not respond to your requests for comment at this time.
Right.
So, Will Carruthers, thanks so much for joining us to clue us in and our listeners to this really important story. The Project Censored Show airs around the country, but we air all over California, and we know people are going to be very interested in that. And wildfires, of course, sadly, are not only happening in Northern California,
sure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so these kind of political shenanigans are really important, and this is exactly why we need something like the Power Brokers series. So Will Carruthers, we'll definitely be having you back on. We'll check in for updates, and we again urge our listeners to go and check out Will Carruthers' reporting. The article is called Juiced. It is at bohemian.com. And Will Carruthers, do you want to share any contact information or other places people can find you online?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Carruthers_W.
Okay, Carruthers. Thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. After this musical interlude, we will continue with our programming. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to continue our showcase on investigative journalism. And we are joined today by Whitney Webb. She is a Mint Press News investigative journalist based in Chile, has contributed to several independent media outlets, including Global Research, EcoWatch, Ron Paul Institute, 21st Century Wire, among many others. She also is co-host of the Mintcast, the podcast for Mint Press News. And you can learn more at mintpressnews.com. Whitney Webb has made several radio and television appearances and is the 2019 winner of the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism. And on the Project Censored Show, we like to highlight uncompromised integrity in journalism. And in our earlier segment, we were speaking with Will Carruthers about PG&E and a lot of the corruption in California, revolving doors and behind-the-scenes networks and conflicts of interest. And lo and behold, we're joined by Whitney Webb, who has been writing about none other than Jeffrey Epstein. Listeners know that Jeffrey Epstein purportedly committed suicide in Manhattan while in prison awaiting trial for his high-profile and controversial case about sex trafficking. And Whitney Webb and I have been trying to connect for a few weeks, and I appreciate that, Whitney Webb, you have made some time to come on. And it is, interestingly, after the passing here of Epstein. So, Whitney Webb, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks so much for having me on the program. I'm glad we could finally connect.
Thank you so much. And I want to also tell listeners that since we've been planning this for a while, the reason we're having you on is to showcase your investigative journalism and to highlight what the free press does best when it's doing what it's supposed to do, and that's provide context. And so we're not going to dive into what happened here on the 10th of August in terms of the shocking and strange and bizarre circumstances surrounding what has happened with Jeffrey Epstein. You actually were doing a great civil service to the rest of us by writing in a Too Big to Fail column. You have this Mint Press News, Too Big to Fail. You did a series on Epstein, and it starts back in mid-July, Hidden in Plain Sight, The Shocking Origins of the Jeffrey Epstein Case. And you write, Epstein is only the latest incarceration of a much older, more extensive, and sophisticated operation that offers a frightening window into how deeply tied the U.S. government is to the modern-day equivalents of organized crime. You follow that up in late July with a piece under the guise of Too Big to Fail, Government by Blackmail, Jeffrey Epstein, Trump's Mentor, and the Dark Secrets of the Reagan Era. Appalling for both the villainous abuse of children itself and the chilling implications of government by blackmail, this tangled web of unsavory alliances casts a lurid light on the political history of the U.S. from the Prohibition era right up through the age of Trump. And 3 days before Epstein was reported to have committed suicide in prison, you published another piece under Too Big to Fail. This was from August 7. Megagroup, Maxwell's, and Mossad, the spy story at the heart of the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. The picture painted by the evidence is not a direct Epstein tie to a single intelligence agency, but but a web linking key members of the mega group, politicians, and officials in both the U.S. and Israel, and an organized crime network with deep business and intelligence ties in both nations. Now, Whitney Webb, that's a lot of material, and I know before we started the interview, you had mentioned that it was up to about 80 pages of writing.
I have a part four coming out that's going to be the last installment, but yeah, I'm basically trying to show this very extensive network. There's a lot of overlap between some of the characters I talk about in part one, part two, and then part three, but it's very dense, and as I mentioned in one of those subtitles of one of my pieces, it's a very tangled web of characters, so it is a lot to keep track of, that's for sure.
It certainly is, and that's why I actually went through, of course, and I know it may seem tedious, I apologize, but I wanted to make sure that I read all of the titles and subtitles so that people could realize how deep this goes and the kind of work that you're actually trying to do in providing background and context, really, for the culture of the power elite globally. And of course, the way sensational corporate media running for the ratings is they look for the salacious, the low-hanging fruit,
right,
and they go on and on and on and speculate endlessly about things that they don't know or might never know. And what you're doing is very different.
Exactly. And one thing I'm doing very differently than mainstream media is that mainstream media is basically trying to paint Jeffrey Epstein as an isolated case, that this was something that began and ended with Jeffrey Epstein. What I show, I think very authoritatively in my reports, is that this is not something that began and ended with him. It's something that has gone on for decades, and it has really been forged by this unholy alliance, if you will, between the CIA and organized crime, an alliance that goes back to World War II, when the CIA worked with figures in the criminal underworld and what was called Operation Underworld, actually, and partnered with people like Mayor Lansky and other mobsters, and that alliance continued well after the war, and that the CIA also forged an alliance, of course, with Mossad, and the person that forged the alliance between all three of these groups was the first counterintelligence chief of the CIA, James Jesus Angleton, who was the CIA liaison, basically, between the CIA and Mayor Lansky and organized crime, and also the liaison between the Mossad and the CIA.
And the Mossad is essentially like the CIA in Israel, yes?
Israeli intelligence is organized differently than the U.S. intelligence, but basically the Mossad is everything that takes place outside of Israel. So like their domestic spy agency is Shin Bet, and they have some military intelligence agencies that are sort of like the NSA, like Unit 8200 and whatnot. But the Mossad is generally for operations that happen outside of Israel and that are planned and executed outside of Israel.
And of course, like the CIA, which is supposed to only be working in foreign affairs, I'm happy that you were able to clarify that for some of our listeners, because a lot of these terms get thrown around somewhat glibly or loosely without context.
For example, every time that Israeli intelligence is implicated in something, a lot of people just say, oh, the Mossad, even if it might have been another intelligence agency of Israel.
And again, this is what I appreciate about your three-part, soon-to-be four-part series, is that you really go into detail about the background, the context. I want you to start telling this story where you think a good place is to kick off. I realize that, you know, again, going back mid-July, the hidden in plain sight piece. Tell listeners, how did you get started on this to find out who is this billionaire sex offender, Jeffrey Epstein? How did he evade justice for so long? So pick a spot to start telling some of this story, because it's a long one. And again, listeners can go online and look for Whitney Webb, W-E-B-B, and you can go to mintpressnews.com to learn more.
So the way I got started on this story was actually quite by accident. When Jeffrey Epstein was first arrested, I didn't plan on writing it. I was actually writing a separate series on a totally different topic. But then it came out that Alex Acosta, who, when he was in Florida's government, had approved the so-called sweetheart deal with Jeffrey Epstein in 2008 that's come under increasing scrutiny. And it came out that he had said the reason he approved that deal is that he had been told that Jeffrey Epstein was intelligence, and he'd been told to back off, and that Epstein was above his pay grade. And this is why he was a high-ranking official in Florida's Justice Department. So that got my attention, and I thought it would be nice to find out definitively, if possible, what intelligence agency that was, if it was a U.S. agency or a foreign agency, because we knew at that time already that Jeffrey Epstein was involved in a sexual blackmail operation, because he was known to have been recording both audio and video, powerful people that he invited to his residences, either in the U.S. or on this island, that he was keeping recordings of these people, basically obtaining blackmail and doing that by exploiting underage girls. So with that background, I decided to go looking, and I thought, well, if I look back into the history of CIA, for example, which I know has done sexual blackmail operations like this in the past, many intelligence agencies do them, maybe I'll find some surprising link to Jeffrey Epstein. And that I did. The first book I picked up, incidentally, was The CIA as Organized Crime, which is by Doug Valentine. I wish more people knew Doug Valentine. He is one of the best researchers on covert operations. So in that book, there was a reference to Mayor Lansky sending Virginia Hill, who has sometimes been called the mistress of the mafia or the mistress of the mob. He would send her to Mexico, and she would lure foreign diplomats and American diplomats in Mexico to places that were bugged to acquire blackmail on them, sexual blackmail specifically. And of course, this was in 1939, and this was before even the CIA was founded, and this was being done by Mayor Lansky. So I knew from previous reports I'd done that Mayor Lansky was very connected to a particular businessman, Samuel Bronfman, who is the father, the patriarch, really, of the Bronfman family. And for those that may remember, there was the recent scandal with the NXIVM sex cult, and the Bronfman daughters were very involved in that. So I thought that was unusual, that there may be something to these seemingly unrelated cases just because of the content of what these operations were both doing. And so I decided from there to go and read a book about the Bronfman family. And in there, the author, Nicholas Faith, who I believe is the former editor for The Economist, he was discussing not Bronfman, but another mob-linked liquor baron of the Prohibition era, Louis Rosenstiel. And it was talking about how Louis Rosenstiel was running a sexual blackmail operation out of his house, and he was doing so along with former FBI director J. Edgar Hoover and Roy Cohn, mm-hmm. who was then general counsel to Senator Joe McCarthy during the McCarthy hearings, but later is better known for being the mentor of the current president, Donald Trump, and that they were doing this first in his house. And apparently it eventually started to take place in the Plaza Hotel in New York, and that this went on for decades, really, with the full complicity of very powerful people in government. And actually, Roy Cohn at one point admitted this, I believe in the 80s, to a former NYPD detective who was then actually in charge of human trafficking. His name is James Rothstein. Basically admitted that this operation existed as part of the anti-communist crusade of the time, sort of as this power struggle to get powerful people to go along with the political agendas of McCarthyism and things like that. That definitely caught my attention because of the players involved, and so I kept digging into this. And part one is mostly focused on this Rosenstiel Hoover and Roy Cohn operation. And then from there in part two, I talk about Roy Cohn and his connections to Reagan and how a lot of officials connected to intelligence during the Reagan era were also involved in a lot of these sexual blackmail operations.
So you're tracing the history back to what becomes known as the National Crime Syndicate. And of course, you mentioned some other criminal luminaries, right? Charles Lucky Luciano, Mo Dalitz.
Right.
I particularly was interested as an historian in the background of this. My mentor in grad school, Dr. Fred V, taught a course on history of organized crime in the United States. And I remember actually being his assistant and going through this class. And so all of these names are very, very familiar to me. But what I found so compelling and interesting in your reporting is it's the tangled web we weave, that all of these people have this network. And you're tracing this up as you get into your second and third piece. You're now looking at Epstein and Trump's mentor and coming through the Reagan era. Talk a little bit about what was happening in the Reagan period as far as Epstein went and as far as some of these relationships went.
A really common factor here, and I'm going to be talking more about this in part four, in Epstein's case specifically, because he was also involved with some people in this scandal, is Iran-Contra. And that a lot of the people that were involved in Iran-Contra had connections to people that were running sexual blackmail operations or child trafficking ring. And this includes Craig Spence, who is a well-known Republican lobbyist in Washington. And he was part of, it's often called the callboy scandal at the White House, because he actually took his callboys on midnight tours of the White House. And this broke out in the Washington Press, I believe, in the late 80s or early 90s. And Craig Spence was actually a close friend of Roy Cohn and hosted birthday parties for Roy Cohn at his home. So there is definitely some overlap there, which I think is quite stunning. In another case, of course, that's probably one of the better known of these sort of child trafficking rings in their connections to political power in the U.S. is the Franklin scandal. that was run by Larry King. Larry King had associations with several Iran-Contra front groups, including one that paid for speeches of Contra leaders and Oliver North and other big players in Iran-Contra. So there's a lot of links from people to Iran-Contra to this network. And I lay out some of the connections that Roy Conda had to powerful people in the Reagan White House, specifically also in the media. One very interesting connection is that according to Roy Cohn's longtime secretary and switchboard operator in his law office, Bill Casey, who was then director of the CIA, called Roy Cohn daily. So I think that's very significant when you look at all the connections that were to the Iran-Contra, which was mostly an intelligence operation, their connections to these sexual blackmail rings. And then Roy Cohn is known to run these blackmail rings. And then Bill Casey is calling Roy Cohn, who is often just described as a lawyer, right? He's calling him every day. I think that's quite telling.
I would say that it's very telling. I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff with Whitney Webb. She is a Mint Press investigative journalist based in Chile. She has contributed to several independent media outlets, and she has made several radio and television appearances, also co-hosts the Mintcast, Mint Press News podcast, and we're speaking with her about her series on Jeffrey Epstein. We're going to continue our conversation with investigative journalist Whitney Webb after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment, we are continuing our highlight on investigative reporting, investigative journalism, and we have the honor of being joined right now by the investigative journalist, Whitney Webb. She is an investigative journalist for Mint Press News, and she's contributed to several independent media outlets and has done many, many radio and television appearances. She's a 2019 winner of Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism. And the reason I said that you've been doing a lot more interviews of late, Whitney Webb, is because your summer series for Mint Press under the Too Big to Fail label has focused on the context and history behind Jeffrey Epstein. And of course, our listeners know that it was reported that Epstein committed suicide while in prison, awaiting a high-profile sex trafficking case with minors. Of course, this has ensnared many, many people over the years, including current President Donald Trump, former President Bill Clinton, many other high-profile people, including former Labor Secretary Alexandra Acosta, who was U.S. Attorney in Florida in a 2007 and 8 period when Jeffrey Epstein pled guilty to a state charge of solicitation involving prostitution of a 14-year-old girl, and it was basically a plea deal here that got him off, no puns intended. This is a horrible, horrible story. But it allowed Epstein basically to have a slap on the wrist and walk. He was arrested earlier this year, and just so happens that Whitney Webb, you were doing a really big series of stories here for Mint Press News, and you're currently working on the fourth installment of this. Before the break, you were talking to us a little bit about the strange relationships and networks, whether it was from the head of the CIA to Cohn to others, and of course in your articles. You also write about celebrity culture, whether it was Andy Warhol, Calvin Klein, all kinds of people that were involved in this strange web where Epstein keeps turning up again and again. In the about 10 or so minutes we have left, perhaps you want to talk a little bit more about the most recent incarnation. This, and I'm not sure when your fourth installment is coming out, but listeners can please go to mintpressnews.com, look for Whitney Webb, W-E-B-B, and you'll see that. But Whitney, your third installment looks at William Barr, is that right?
It only talks about William Barr just a little bit. Part three is mostly about the connection to the mega group,
right?
And the Mossad, and specifically Robert Maxwell, who is the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, who is alleged to have been the madam of Jeffrey Epstein, who procured a lot of these girls for him and also was engaged in the abuse of these girls as well.
I can't forget some of the history of this and how Barr's father was involved.
Well, let's talk about Bill Barr for a second, because there's a lot of history to him that some people forget. So yes, Donald Barr is believed to be the person who hired Jeffrey Epstein at the Dalton School, even though he was not qualified. Donald Barr previously had worked for the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA. Not long before he hired Epstein, I believe a year prior, he was also a fantasy sci-fi novelist. He wrote a novel called Space Relations about sex slavery and human trafficking a year before he hired Jeffrey Epstein at the Dalton School, which is quite odd when you consider what Epstein was later arrested for. But going to Bill Barr also got his start at the CIA. He worked for the Office of Legislative Counsel in the late 70s when George Bush Sr. was CIA director. His main task there was basically to stonewall the Church Committee and also the related Pike Committee, both of which were investigating CIA wrongdoing during that period. And one of the things that Bill Barr at the time and some of his associates at that office in the CIA were trying to prevent sexual blackmail operations specifically from being aired out to these committees, which is quite noticeable there. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the Iran-Contra Network and its involvement in these types of sexual blackmail operations. When he was Attorney General under Bush Sr., he was the person that wrote the legal justifications for the pardon of many of these Iran-Contra figures, including some that were implicated in some of these blackmail rings. So I think that is a very significant background.
When he was appointed Attorney General under Donald Trump, going back and looking at that history that you have, and then, of course, one of his roles at the DOJ was to move the Mueller report on, right?
Right.
To redact and censor that.
Another thing about Bill Barr is that before he became Attorney General under Trump, he was working at Kirkland & Ellis, which is the law firm that defended Jeffrey Epstein in 2007 and 2008.
These aren't coincidences in my mind. This is a pretty interesting network here that is actually, as you say, hiding in plain sight. You went back and are piecing this puzzle together.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, this is stuff that's all in the public record. I just happened to piece it together for people, but there's a reason this didn't come out for so long. I think the internet certainly helped, but I would encourage everyone who takes a look at my articles, everything I use, I source in there in the form of hyperlinks. Please follow those links to see this for yourself, because a lot of this sounds really crazy, right? Especially when you consider what the mainstream narrative about Jeffrey Epstein is coming out in the media right now, that he was just this billionaire up to no good all by himself. I would really encourage people to not just take my word for it, see the sources I use and come to your own conclusions, because it's really important that people have a good idea of the broader picture of what's really going on here. Because frankly, what they're saying now, right, is that now that Jeffrey Epstein's dead, this case is going to die with him. The criminal case will die with him, even though civil suits will continue. But there are other people implicated in this. And I honestly think if anyone actually cares about justice for the victims and to prevent something like this from happening again, that the people that are still alive and not in prison for these sorts of activities deserve to be pursued, beginning with Ghislaine Maxwell. And as far as I know, no one even knows where she is right now.
That's really important that you brought up the corporate media narrative on this. And it's very important that you also remind us of the victims. We don't even know how many there are.
Believed to be in the thousands. The depositions that have come out have only been from a handful of the victims, but he's believed to have abused thousands of girls. So this is really much bigger than mainstream media is painting it. They've actually mostly just focused on the accusations of two or three, at the most five victims that have gotten the most coverage. But really, there's hundreds, if not thousands more.
And so we certainly hope that this isn't the end of the case, but rather really creates impetus to push further and harder and look deeper into what's going on with this strange, strange case. And in fact, I want to remind listeners that your series is called The Jeffrey Epstein Scandal, Too Big to Fail. Parts 1, 2, and 3 are at mintpressnews.com. We're speaking with investigative journalist Whitney Webb. In the few minutes we have left, Whitney Webb, Part 4 is going to be out soon. Can you give listeners a little bit of information about what direction are you taking this? You mentioned it's the last part of the four-part series. And again, you're not going down the rabbit hole of the suicide watch and the last days of Epstein and so on. So how are you wrapping your investigative report?
I'm going to talk about one of the main Epstein connections that I haven't covered yet, and that would be to the Clintons. I'm also going to be talking about one of the Mossad-linked businessmen that were close to other associates of Jeffrey Epstein and the mega group, one of the mega group associates that was linked to Mossad that I talked about in part three was Robert Maxwell. But the one I haven't gotten a chance to talk about yet was Mark Rich, who actually ended up being pardoned by Clinton during his last days in office. So I'll be talking about that. I'll also be talking about Epstein's links to a lot of the arms dealers involved in Iran-Contra, where he sits in this network. And how after he stopped working for those arms dealers is the exact year that Leslie Wexner, a member of the mega group, started to be his financial patron, so to speak. And he sort of got involved in this. The beginning of what became his sexual blackmail operation started to emerge. And of course, he met up with Ghislaine Maxwell in 1991 and soon thereafter was introduced to the Clintons through, I believe, Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, who I'll be talking about a good bit in part four of my piece, because she actually married into the family of Louis Rosenstiel in the early 90s. She divorced in 1993 and later went to marry into the Rothschild family. She's also in business with several mega group people, including Ronald Lauder. She's on the board of the Estee Lauder companies with him. She runs a co-investment firm with the Bronfman family. She's very connected into this whole network I've been pointing out, and she is a major Clinton backer. Actually spent her honeymoon in the White House while Clinton was president. And I'm going to be talking about Jeffrey Epstein's ties to Clinton in the early 90s and also the Clintons' involvement in the Iran-Contra network, which goes back to the time when he was governor of Arkansas and the MENA airport and some other big players there that were connected to them. Because a lot of people have said, oh, you've just focused on Trump, you've just focused on the Republicans, what about the Democrats? Well, I'm getting to that in part four. With the Epstein case, a lot of people on the left and the right have tried to weaponize this really for political and partisan purposes. What I really want to show in my series is that this is a bipartisan issue. This goes on with both parties. This totally transcends party divisions. This is crime, systemic crime, that involves people, powerful people from both parties, and the rot at the top. It does not discriminate whether someone is a Republican or a Democrat.
Again, this is what makes this series really significant for me. It really reminds me a lot of the heyday of muckraking with the great Lincoln Steffens in the Shame of the Cities series, where he started looking at, as you say, the rot, bipartisan rot in one place in St. Louis. And the next thing you know, he's in cities around the country. And lo and behold, it's Republicans, it's Democrats. It's a power elite thing. Kudos to you, Whitney Webb, for following this story and really having the courage to go deeply and tell it and not be distracted by the so many other bizarre and titillating features of it that the corporate media can't seem to let go of. And you really push a lot of that aside to go deep into the heart of this story. And we're definitely looking forward to the fourth part. Again, we've been speaking with investigative reporter Whitney Webb to learn more about her series on the Jeffrey Epstein scandal, Too Big to Fail. It's in three parts, fourth part coming out very soon. Go to mintpressnews.com. And Whitney Webb, we hope to have you back on the program again. I mentioned earlier that you'd been doing so many interviews. It just so happens that since you've been doing this, that, you know, the Epstein death report came out and people have been really interested in this. So I'm happy at least for the fact that you're getting the attention that you deserve in your significant in-depth investigative reporting about the context of the power elite as manifest in the Epstein scandal. So thank you, Whitney Webb, for your good reporting.
It was a pleasure to be on. Thanks for the opportunity.
That does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm the executive producer, Mickey Huff, and host of the program with co-host Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or to find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work. You can contact us through projectcensored.org. Last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. But change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain. But my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the thought brothers and our sisters. Together can overthrow the system. We got that love of the Doe brothers and your sisters. The people together.
habitualize alibis, disguise another guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by taxes while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.